Welcome to the weekly sermon podcast of Valley Grove Baptist Church. We are thankful you stopped by to hear from God's Word, to grow closer to Him, and to be inspired to reach your area of influence. So we're going to have to go quickly today. I'm going to be honest with you. It would probably take several weeks for us to hit all of the points that we could talk about in this passage, because there are that many. There's cultural implications, which we're going to talk about a little bit. Social, theological, obviously, Christological. There's how Jesus, we could even talk about this from a speaking standpoint of how you engage people and questions you ask to get a certain point across that you're trying to make. There are so many different things we could talk about in this passage, and there's no way we can talk about all of them today, but we're going to kind of hit the high notes, and we'll go from there, all right? So let me kind of set the stage. This passage, these 45 verses, are broken down into three sections, like three acts of a play. The first section has a little bit of an introduction, and then mainly it is conversation between a woman and Jesus. Then the second act is between Jesus and the disciples, and the third act is between the rest of the city she's from and Jesus, and then John kind of tidies it up at the end with some little editorial comments, all right? And what we're going to do today is we're going to try to look at the first and the third act of the play and save Jesus' conversation with just the disciples for next week, okay? So that's how we're going to go. That's at least the plan today. Right now, we may have to adjust a little bit, but that's it. All right, let's begin reading. We're going to read and talk, and then we're going to kind of ask what on your outline is called a clarifying question, and then we'll eventually end with some application for us. All right, here we go. John 4:1. Now, when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John. So words got out, Jesus baptizing more disciples than John. Although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples. He left Judea and departed for Galilee. Now this is the important verse in this section, okay? Verse 4. There's geographical... This is the verse you need to hang on in verses 1 through 6. And he, Jesus, had to pass through Samaria. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, so Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour or lunch, 12 o'clock noon. All right, so here's what you need to realize from this passage. There's a lot of geography and stuff we could get into, but we're not. You need to realize verse 4 is the key verse, really, that sets the stage for the entire rest of the conversation. Because what you need to realize is Jesus could have gone any number of ways. We're going to talk about this more at the end, so hang on to it. Jesus could have gone any number of ways to get to Galilee from where he was. John could have wrote, he could have, because this is not in red letters in your Bible, this is John's editorial comment. John could have said, Jesus passed through Samaria, right? Means the same thing. He could have said Jesus was going through Samaria, right? But he doesn't. He adds a little three-letter word. Some of your Bibles, it may be must, depending on your translation. ESV says, and he had to pass through Samaria. Now, why does John say it that way? He doesn't have to say it that way. So the question we've got to ask is, why does he say it that way? And the reason he says it the way it is because right here in verse number 4, before the rest of the 41 verses that come in this story, John is giving us a hint that there is more than just GPS locations and travel routes and roads going on in this story, but rather we are about to read a story that has a divine agenda attached alongside of it. So before we know what happens in the story, we know that it's more than just, oh, well, we're here, so we should take this highway to get there. No, God's agenda is pushing the movements of this story. All right, we'll pick it up. Verse number 7. And this is where the action starts. A woman of Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." Why did Jesus say, "Give me a drink"? Because he was wearied from his journey. It was hot. It was noon. He was thirsty. Here's what the woman says. For the disciples had gone into the city to buy food. So it's just Jesus and just the woman. Okay? That'll be important for later. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria?" John adds a little note. For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. Verse 10. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." So Jesus is talking in the third person. Basically, he's saying, if you knew who I were and what I had, you would have asked me for water, not me asking you for water. Verse 11. The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with." Correct, because Jesus is on a journey. He's not carrying a bucket around with him. "And the well is deep. Where do you get living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us this well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." Verse 13. Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." And here's where this kind of section of the conversation ends. Verse 15. The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." Now, let's stop right here. Both pause, because this is the first half of this first act of the play. Now, there's a lot of things going on, but I want to dial up a couple of those for you this morning. This is now the third time in just four chapters that we have seen somebody completely misunderstand the point Jesus is trying to make. The first time that occurred was at the cleansing of the temple. Do you remember what Jesus said? "You destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up again." And Jesus, John says, was talking about the temple of his body and how he would be killed, buried for 3 days in the tomb and rise up on the third day on Easter Sunday. But the people listening around thought, how is he going to tear down this temple that took 40 some odd years to build and rebuild it in 3 days? That's ludicrous. They misunderstood what Jesus said. Do you remember the story of Nicodemus? What does Jesus tell Nicodemus? "You must be born again." And what does Nicodemus say? "How can a man enter his mother's womb for a second time and be birthed again?" Natural question, right? But he completely misses the point that Jesus is trying to make. Jesus is talking about spiritual things up here. And the people in the temple and Nicodemus are on an earthly level. This lady here is now the third. This isn't the last time we'll see this either. In fact, in the future, we'll see the disciples do this as well. Jesus is talking about spiritual matters. The woman is on the earthly plane. And you see that. She says three times, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask me for water? Where can I get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? Hey, give me this water so I don't have to come here and do this all every day." She is continually thinking that Jesus is talking on a physical plane. But what does Jesus say? Jesus is first, he talks about living water. So let's go ahead and get this out of the way first. What is living water? Why would Jesus say that? That's not a common term that you hear in Upson County in 2022. I mean, you don't go around and say, "Hey man, I had some great living water today." You don't say that. But it does have a context for the first century. Living water in the first century referred to moving water, not still water. So Jesus uses an earthly term, but gives it a spiritual dimension. and translates that into spiritual matters. Living water was moving water because moving water had life for them, whereas still water didn't. And so when she asks him, where's this living water? She's thinking in her mind, this guy has access to physical moving water, which is obviously better than dead water. I mean, growing up, we had land in South Georgia, and me and my buddies, they hunted in South Georgia. And so we would go to South Georgia. And one thing you notice about South Georgia is there's swamps. Swamps. And if you've ever been to a swamp, it has a unique odor. And the reason it has a unique odor is because the water is dead. Like, what I mean by that is it's not moving. On the property that my dad owns, we have several wet weather swamps. Beautiful cypress trees in them, huge. They've got big bells at the end of them that are massive. And they grow there because it stays wet. But if you go there in the summer, it's stinks, it's tannic, it's dead, there's mosquitoes and cottonmouths. It's not a place you want to be. Now, it's great for other things. It's great for these trees and all that, but it's not living water. Like, you're not going to go up there and dip a bucket in it and think, man, this is going to be great. Because the minute you pull the bucket up, you see stuff floating all around in it moving. And you're like, oh, this is gross. So when Jesus says living water, he's not talking about that. He's referring to living water. And she thinks he's meaning he has access. He owns property somewhere and he's got access to moving, flowing water. And she's like, man, give me some of that. But Jesus is taking this example, just like he took the example of the temple, and just like he took the example from birth. And he translates that into a spiritual dimension. And he tells the lady, no, what you really need is not this water. You need the water that I give, and that water is living water. And then she asks a question, and he says in verse 13, everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. In other words, if you drink this well water, you will eventually need to come here tomorrow and get more because you will run out of it. But the water that I give will allow you to never be thirsty again. In fact, it will create in you a spring that continually reproduces living water inside your life. In other words, what is Jesus saying? He's saying, let's put it to you bluntly. Jesus is telling the woman, lady, you are coming here because you have physical thirst in your life. I'm telling you, you have another thirst in your life, and it's of your soul. And this well water ain't going to do a thing to quench the thirst, the dryness, the parched soul that resides inside of you. But I have what you need, and I'm willing to give it to you. In fact, you should have asked me for it, because if I give you the living water that I have, your soul will never be dry and parched again. In fact, the opposite will occur. In fact, that water that I give you, that living soul water that I give you, it will create in you not a dry, parched desert, but you will be an oasis of life that will continually produce water over and over and over until you reach eternity. And so the woman's astounded. And she's like, hey, give me some of this water. So, and we know she's still talking about physical water, because in verse 15, look how she ends her comment. She says, hey, give me some of this water so I won't be thirsty, not spiritually, but so I won't have to come back here again. Like, hey, give me what you're selling so that I don't have to make this journey from town to the well every day. And so Jesus, being Jesus, switches gears on her to help her understand just how, A, what he's really talking about, and B, her need for what he really has in the second set of questions. So in verse 16, Jesus makes this statement, go, call your husband, and come here. And the woman answered him, I have no husband. Jesus said to her, you are right in saying I have no husband, for you have had five, and the one you have now is not your husband. What you have said is true. The woman said to him, sir, this may be the most captain obvious statement of the whole thing. I perceive that you are a prophet. You think? Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place of worship, or where people ought to worship. And Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming, and listen to this, verse 23, and is now here, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such a people to worship Him. Verse 24, God is spirit. Those who worship Him must worship in spirit and in truth. Then the woman said to him, I know the Messiah is coming. He was called the Christ. When He comes, He will tell us all things. And then in verse 26, in an amazing statement, Jesus tells, for the first time in the gospel, listen to me, for the first time in the gospel, and what we will see is a morally, ethically bankrupt Samaritan woman, He basically tells her who He really is. Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am He. And we won't read the rest of the verse, but after that, she runs back to town to get everybody to come. Okay? So let's walk through this passage. Now, for us, Jesus' first statement in verse 16 kind of sounds harsh, right? Because He obviously knows the ethical life moral situation and moral choices she's made, correct? Because He tells them He tells her what they are. And in verse 16, He says, hey, woman, go call your husband. Now, why would He do that? Because honestly, if He already knew the situation, that kind of seems harsh, doesn't it? Kind of seems brash, kind of seems mean-spirited. But here's what Jesus is trying to do, because it's none of those things. Because remember, the first set of conversation that they had, Jesus is trying, He is pushing her to realize He's not talking about physical water. He's talking about spiritual, life-giving water that she needs because her soul is dry, thirsty, and parched. It's like a desert in there. There's no life. And so Jesus asks this question, or not asks this question, but makes this statement rather, to help her connect the dots of how dry and thirsty and parched and a desert her soul really is. In other words, as one commentator said, He is relating her need for spiritual water with the ethics of her sexual decisions. In other words, He's calling her out. Just kind of pause here for a second. In our culture today, a lot of times, church is just meant to be a church. And the Bible is just meant to be personal. And Jesus is meant to be, hey, don't get into my business. Come on now. Right? Y'all can check. It's okay. Yes. Yes. Right? What does Jesus do? Boy, He's all up in her business. Why? Because her decisions and her choices, or her lack of good choices and her moral bankruptcy, is the result of her desperate need for what Jesus has. She just don't know it. And Jesus is trying to get her to the point where she knows it. And so He's getting all up in her business so that she will realize who she really is. He already knows who she is. But He knows she ain't gonna ask for help until she realizes who she is. And so He's trying to get her to realize, you actually really need my help. You really need what I'm offering. In fact, it's the only thing that's gonna help. And so Jesus asks a very pointed, in her business question. Now, the woman quickly deflects, like many of us do. When someone tries to get in our business and we don't like it, what do? We deflect. We put up a wall and we go the other way. That's exactly what she does. Because what does she talk about immediately? Not, oh man, you're so right. I've been a terrible person. I've made bad decisions. Please help. No, she don't say none of that. What does she say? Well, actually, let's talk about worship. And she gets into this conversation about worship. And Jesus follows her, brings her back in. Then she talks about the end times. Because listen, we can all talk about the end times, right? Because, hey, that's all. Hey, Jesus, oh, the end times. And so she journeys over to the end times. And Jesus draws her back. And at the end says, I am the person who you've been looking for. Now listen to me. Listen to me. Listen to me. Listen to me. If you haven't heard anything I need to say, anything yet, you need to listen to this, okay? Listen to this. Listen to me. After Jesus says, I who speak to you am He, that's when she leaves. As the story goes on, she eventually comes back. She believes in Jesus. She comes back and brings her whole town with her. And many of them believe in Jesus because they not only just hear her testimony, but they see Jesus for themselves. Okay, so listen to me. Listen to me. What is the nexus for when she runs away? It is when she sees who she really is combined with who Jesus really is. Listen to me. The point at which you will go forward in your relationship with the Lord, the point at which you will grow, is not when you just see who Jesus is. It is the point at which you see who Jesus really is and you actually acknowledge who you really are when nobody else is around. And it, like when you get honest with yourself about here's who I really am, that's when Jesus can change your life. But until then, you're just playing games. We're just all playing games. Because that's the moment she runs away and is like, whoa, wait a minute, this guy, I gotta have what he's selling. And that's the point. Listen to me. That's the point, my friend, when her life changes. Not until then. Until that point, she wants to talk about worship. She wants to talk about churchy stuff. She wants to talk about this over here, the end times. She wants to talk about this. She wants to pretend and play and act like she's got it all together. But it is not until she gets real about who she really is and who Jesus really is that her life begins to change. And that's the same way for us. Look at me. Look at me. I'm going to take a break. This is not on your outline. This is free. You can come in here all you want to, as much as you want to. You can memorize verses, say memorizes, sing song, give, you know, give $1,000 to Kate, do whatever, which would be great, right? But anyway, you do whatever. But your heart and life can still walk out of here dry and parched because you have yet to see who you really are and what Jesus has to give you and connect to the dots that you really need what He has. This woman figures it out. This woman has a changed life because she put those two realities together and said, I know, I get who I really am now. Morally bankrupt. Jesus has the answer that I need. My life is a desert. He has living water. I need what He has. And so that's how the story ends. And she runs away. Well, not how the story ends. This is how this part ends. She runs away to go and tells the town. The disciples come back. We'll talk about that next week. When she brings the rest of the town back, a bunch of the town follows her. At first, they only believe her because of her testimony. But they encourage Jesus to stay with them 2 more days. So Jesus stays in a Samaritan town for 2 more days. And then John records, many of them said, I don't only believe because of her testimony, but I believe because I have seen and heard myself. So here's kind of the bottom line for this lady. Because she connected the dots of who she really was with what Jesus has and that she really needed what Jesus has, many people came to believe in Jesus. What do you think would have had a hypothetical situation? It's theoretical. We don't know. This isn't reality. What if she had just stayed over here and said, Jesus, you're wrong. That's not who I really am. Do you think many people would have believed in Jesus? Do you think they'd asked Jesus to stay 2 days with them? Probably not. What if she had just said, well, yeah, maybe you're the Messiah, but I don't have a problem. I really need what you're selling. Do you think many people would have believed in Jesus? Probably not. But because one person decided to put who they really are with what Jesus really had together, many people believed in Jesus. Can I throw one other thing to you real quick? Toss one thing out. I don't know really the exact connection with this, but in Acts, early in Acts, do you know what happens early in Acts? There's a guy named Philip. And you know where Philip goes? Do you know who Philip evangelizes first? The Samaritans. the Samaritan. In other words, Philip takes the final message of Jesus, because as far as we know, Jesus never goes through Samaria again. This is it. And 3 years later, or more, at least 3 years later, because this is the beginning of Jesus' ministry, so maybe like more like 4, 5, 6 years later, this guy named Philip comes back and he's like, hey, you know that Jesus y'all heard about? Guess what? Let me tell you what happened to him. And the Holy Spirit falls. People believe in Jesus. And lives are transformed. Now, am I making the dot that because Philip went to the exact same town this lady went to? I'm not saying that. But look, Samaria is not really big. It's not a huge land area. So I'm sure most people knew about the lady who had five husbands who was living with the sixth. And when her life gets changed, everybody takes notice. So that years later, when somebody comes back, they're like, hey, yeah, I heard about that guy. Why? Because one person decided to put their reality of who they really were with the reality of who Jesus is and allow Jesus to change your life. Now, what does that have to do with us? Really quickly, we've only got about 9 minutes, okay? Listen to me. Here's the clarifying question we've got to ask today beyond what we've learned. This is just what the story tells us. We haven't yet applied it to where it fits into our lives and what we learn about Jesus. But listen to me. Here's the clarifying question. Why is this story important? Why, or maybe even ask this, why did John choose to add this story into the gospel? We know that there are many stories that John did not add into his gospel. He tells us so in John 20, 30 through 31. He writes the purpose of the book and he says, there are many other signs and wonders that Jesus did that are not included in this book. So John didn't have to include this story in his book, but he chose to, right? Divine providence, he chose to put this story, John chapter 4, in his gospel. He was not required to, he didn't have to, but he did. So the question I have is, why is it in there? Why is it important? And here's to me why the story is important. Listen to me. Here's the answer to the clarifying question of why is this story so important. Because listen to me, this story right here should have never happened. It's not just that it shouldn't have made it into the book. Like, John should have not had this story in his bank when he was making his rough draft like we learned in school. And, you know, you kind of brainstorm out ideas. This should not even have been in the brainstorm category, because the story should have never taken place at all. Why? Three reasons. Culturally, socially, theologically. Culturally, it shouldn't take place because, as John lightly put it, the Jews had no dealings with the Samaritans. Why? Because they hated the Samaritans. And the Samaritans hated them. This hatred goes back longer than... about as long as people, Europeans, have been in America. 500 years. 500 years or more, they've hated each other. Has your family hated anybody for 500 years? No, you probably can't even go back far in that your genealogy family tree. But the Jews, they've hated the Samaritans since the 10 tribes of Israel were conquered by Assyria. 500 or more years, they have been at odds. They hated the Samaritans so much, listen to me, that when people traveled from Jerusalem and Judea to Galilee, they went completely out of their way. And if you look on a map, Samaria, it's Galilee's up here in the north, then it's Samaria, and then there's Judea. And you could travel in a straight line roughly between the two. But you know what most Jews did? They did like this. It'd be like you hating Atlanta so much that you went to South Carolina to get to Tennessee. It's like you go to Augusta and go around this way to get to Chattanooga versus going straight through Atlanta. That's how much they would rather chance coming in contact with Gentiles than they would the Samaritans. This story should have never happened because Jesus should have never been there. He should have never been there, but the text tells us he had to go through there. Here's the second reason. Socially, it was unethical. It was not common practice. I shouldn't say unethical. It was just not common practice for a man to speak to another assumed married woman without her husband present in public. So even if Jesus was, he should have never even talked to the woman. You say, what was he supposed to do? Just be thirsty? Yep. Just sit there till the disciples get back, and then they'll figure it out. You say, well, that's weird. That's not what we've done here. It doesn't matter what we do here. That's what Jesus would have done. And the fact that Jesus was considered a rabbi, a teacher of the law, for him to have a conversation by himself with nobody else around with a morally bankrupt woman puts his status as a teacher at jeopardy. The conversation should have never happened. And it should have never happened because they can't even agree about basic theology. They had wildly different views of theology. The conversation should have never happened. But it does. And why it does is important for us today in how we should live and what we can learn from the story and what we can apply to our lives. And there's three areas that we can apply this to our lives, and it comes through what we see Jesus. Jesus cared more about this person than cultural or social norms. In other words, Jesus cared more about her than he did about what people might say about him. He didn't care when his own disciples come back, which we'll see last week, they're like, why is he talking to her? What are they talking about? But nobody said anything to him. Why would they even say that? Because they knew that Jesus shouldn't even be talking to this woman. But why does he? Because he cares about people. So what should we do? We should care about people, even if it means crossing stereotypical social norms and cultural ideas. Because let's ask this question. Was the cultural idea or ideology that the Jews had to hate the Samaritans, was that a good one? Probably not. It was just a cultural ideology. Was the social idea that, you know, you couldn't have conversations with certain people a good one? Well, maybe, maybe not, but it wasn't in the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not talk to a woman at the well. So it's just social ideology. We have those same ones here today. And if we're going to care about people, we've got to care about people the way that Jesus cared about people. Here's the second thing. Jesus cared about her so much that he was willing to tell her the truth. Willing to tell her the truth. And part of that truth was not only confronting her about who she really was, but revealing how she could be helped. See, a lot of times in our society, in our culture, in our own personal lives, we're really good at pointing the finger, but we're not really good at giving solutions, right? Jesus did both. He said, hey, this is where you're at, but here's how this can be fixed. And so we've got to do both. You've got to care about people enough to speak to them, and then you've got to help give solutions as well. And then ultimately, at the end of the day, Jesus tells her what worship is really like. And worship is really about a refreshed heart and a refreshed life being renewed to the point where we can worship God as He desires to be worshiped. So, as we go out, what's our challenge for today? What's our challenge for today? It's really simple. God wants you to be refreshed in your heart and life, first and foremost. Because if you're not refreshed with His living water, you're not going to be doing any refreshing of those people around you. You're not going to care about people because you can't when you're dry, thirsty, and it's a desert in your soul. If your soul is a desert, you're not going to care about anybody else because it's a desert in there. Listen to me real quick. I'll tell you a story. It was the summer of 1996. I was a freshman in high school. Summer. It was August. Beginning of August. It was hot. It was like 100, August, September, somewhere in there. It was still hot. We were playing football. And We played, at that time we had just a ninth grade team, a JV team, and a varsity team. And so I was in ninth grade, so we had our own team. And we were pretty good. Like, I mean, not trying to brag or anything, but like we had some athletes on our team. I mean, athletes. And so we had won the first game, won the first two games. We tied the third game, like against one of our rivals, Houston County, like 8-8 or something like that. Or anyway, and the fourth game we played Baldwin County. Baldwin County was terrible. On paper, we should have beat the brakes off of. I mean, we should have just beat their eyes out. I mean, just like run them in the ground. Like our second team should have been playing after halftime. However, we lost the game miserably because we didn't execute, mental mistakes, errors, just all that. I mean, we lost bad. Like, and so uncharacteristically, our coaches said, because on Fridays, we didn't have practice because varsity played and we all got to dress out for varsity because in the rare occasion that we won by so much, we'd get to play at the end of the varsity game, which happened a couple times. So we didn't practice. But we had a home game that night and they said, y'all better be on the field at 3:30 or it's going to be bad. And whew. So we were out there at 3:30. We had no idea what to expect because we had lost. It's the first loss we'd ever had. And so we're like, oh my gosh, what's going to go on? We ran. And we ran. We did suicides. I don't know if y'all know what those are. It's like 10 and back, 20 and back, 30 and back, 40 and back, 50 and back. And we just did those. Then we did what we called black holes, which were 100 yards and back, 100 yards and back. And then we had a hill like over there at the middle school, and we ran the hill by ourselves. And then we ran the hill with the dummy. So you carried a tackling dummy up the hill. And then we ran the hill with a person. So you got an equal weighted person, and they got on your back, and we ran up the hill with them. And then we ran some more. We did Oklahoma drills, and we did this. And listen to me, there were no water breaks. None. We practiced for like an hour and a half. No water breaks. Now, of course, they'd get thrown under the jail now for doing that. We had no water breaks. Y'all are familiar with the phrase cotton mouth, like where your spit gets, your saliva gets dry, and you're like really thirsty? I had, and this is going to be a little gross, but I promise there's a point. I had cotton mouth so bad that my spit was ceasing to be liquid. It had become a solid. It was literally like tissue paper in my mouth. That's how thirsty I was. At the end of practice, we looked like we were dead. And so none of us could get to the water fountain fast enough. And we all, I mean, there was like fight almost breaking out of the water fountain because the person in front of you didn't move quick enough because all of us are that way. And there's like 50 of us out there, 40 of us. And so that water, I don't think I've ever tasted water so good in my life. It was so refreshing. And then I called my dad and I was like, I'm dying. I need something to eat. And so he brought me like a double Whopper. I don't know if any of y'all have ate a double Whopper. Man, I said, I want a double Whopper with large fry and a Coke. That never tasted so good. That Coke going down was, it was so refreshing after having drank that water. And then we went out and we stood on the sidelines and cheered and yelled because that's what you were supposed to do at the varsity game. And so we were like, touchdown. Because, you know, we were still so kind of recovered. That water never tasted so good in my life. And look at me. That dryness that I had physically is what many of us are experiencing spiritually in our lives. It is like we are a desert. We have no viability inside of us. And Jesus wants to refresh us and give us life. And instead of having a desert in us, create an oasis that continually springs up life. So the first challenge for you today is to simply ask the question, am I a desert or am I an oasis? Because you can only be one or the other. You can't be both. Am I a desert or am I an oasis? And the second question Jesus wants us to ask today, after we've personally been refreshed, are we refreshing other people? Are you and I refreshing other people? Or are we making them more desert-like? Right? one. You're only going to be doing one or the other. You're either going to be making people dry or you're going to be refreshing their spirit. You got to be refreshed first, then are you refreshing other people?
Thanks for listening. For more information about Valley Grove, visit our Facebook page or website, valleygrovechurch.org.